The year is 1999. Within the box, evidence that some things do not change with the passage of time. Its contents, the collected debris of a shattered life, now valuable only for the dimes and nickels they can solicit from a third party.
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 14, Podcast Like It's 1999. I am Dream Team Alternate David T. Cole, and I'm here with Genie in a Bottle, Sarah D. Bunting.
You've got to rub me the right way.
And Y2K Bugger, Tara Ariana. Hello, patrons. Welcome to another episode of Extra, Extra Hot Great, the podcast that puts an extra extra in Extra Hot Great. Quickly, results from our network draft episode 13. The results are in. I am in last place, decidedly so, with 23 votes. Sarah is in second place with 30 and eking out a victory. Tara with 33 votes. Congratulations.
Hooray, TBS.
Weak. Yeah. When we finished, I don't know if you included this part on the version that went, but because we were comparing this to the Law and Order draft, I said it would be funny if what put me over was that I got Law and Order, just like Lenny put over Alan when we did the Law and Order draft. And that seems to be, judging by the comments, what has occurred. People really love their Law and Order reruns.
Yeah. It makes total sense.
And when I put Lenny as captain for Star Trek in the Star Trek draft, that's probably what clinched it for me.
But the draft is not our topic today.
It is not. For today's episode, we are hopping in our time machines to imagine what an Extra Hot Great main episode might look like in 1999. It is all sequels and prequels and scripted content these days, and we're no different slash better than anyone else. So let's do this. In a late 20th century iteration of Extra Hot Great, what is the main topic on the podcast? What is everyone talking about for Around the Dial? What would be put up for the canon? And who is winning and losing? We are going to go around the horn and just do our like complete rundown of everything with various people chiming in at various points. I will begin. I selected the week of November 15th, 1999.
Mm.
I was going to take my birthday week, but sweeps was still really a thing. And the March dead time was really a thing. And there was like nothing on.
Oh, yeah.
So I moved it to November. First of all, our guest would be our esteemed colleague and my fellow Matt from Real World Hawaii Despiser, Kim Reed. And the main topic would be Real World Hawaii, which would have just aired its cringerific two-part season finale.
Wow, it lasted a long time.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Blue, it is you. So that's what I'm talking about. There was like plenty of other sweepsy, networky stuff going on, but I went with Real World Hawaii because I actually, frankly, was just pained that it's been 20 years since that happened. For my Around the Dial, I went with ER, Season 6, Episode 6, The Piece of Wild Things, which is Carrie and Mark having to trick Alan, Dr. Folksy, Alda, into admitting that he has dementia. Mm. Super pregnant St. Carol gets Martha Plimpton arrested, and Reese might not be Peter's kid, and Carla is a bitch about it. And I figured that everyone else would be doing the following. Kim would take SVU. That was in its first season. It would have just aired an extremely ham-fisted take on what happens when you make assumptions about people on the sex offender registry.
Back when we all could still not help ourselves calling it SUV.
People still do that.
I still can't. I struggle. Tara was on the Dawson's Creek detail. Jen, quote, scandalizes Capeside with a drag show. And we as a group would dread the next episode, which, if you recall, I had completely blocked this out, was an homage to the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
What a way to end the 90s.
90s.
No kidding.
Dave was going to talk about Law and Order Mothership. Fittingly, because it's the one where Jamie Ross returns in that wrongful conviction episode featuring corrupt Judge Richard Masseur. And then the panel would discuss how we were liking Abby Carmichael so far in season 9.
Mm.
Hang them all. For the canon, Kim actually submits a nonack, Little House on the Prairie, season 7, episodes 17 and 18, Sylvia parts 1 and 2. I'm sure any familiarity with that show, you don't need me to explain it, but in case you don't, that's the one where Sylvia is raped by a mime. Mm-hmm. Winners and losers, Jerry
Wait,
Seinfeld.
Hold on. Yes. Like, a guy who's a mime, or like she gets raped like by a mime in makeup? I know that's a weird detail to ask about, but now that the picture's on my head, I feel like I need to finish it.
I don't think it's silent.
Okay, one more question. I apologize. Is it a real rape or is it a mime rape?
It is a real assault.
You don't apologize. You're not sorry.
You're not.
That's a very infamous episode, but yeah, I'm sure I saw it at some point, but I don't recall if it was like full makeup or what the deal was.
I don't either. Mm. I mean, would they have had mime masks in Walnut Creek in the 1800s? I don't know. I don't want to know. Kim Reed, let us know what the deal is there. Winners and losers, Jerry Seinfeld has been married to that lady, Jessica, for almost 20 years. He got engaged to her during that week.
Oh, wow.
And this is around when dehydrated and exhausted jokes started, apparently, because Moesha star Brandi Norwood was hospitalized for same, officially. Perhaps she had just had it officially. I don't remember what the actual story ended up being. And that is my extra hot great lineup now with 11-inch pants rise.
Love it.
So mine is from mid-May 1999. Mm-hmm. Our main topic is...
NBC Studios proudly presents 2-time Golden Globe nominee, Rob Lowe.
Bring us down!
In the heart-pounding high-speed adventure...
Down!
Atomic Train.
Who is this cowboy chasing us?
John Seeger. Investigates train wrecks.
We ain't a train wreck yet.
But the runaway train destined for Denver is hiding a deadly secret.
That train on TV... It's carrying a nuclear weapon in one of the boxcars. A Russian-made nuclear weapon.
All right, I think I found it.
Who the hell put a nuclear bomb on my train?
Now, as the atomic train hits lethal velocity...
I want to flood manpower and containment equipment into the area as soon as possible. If that missile goes, we're all going with it.
The president turns to one man to work a miracle.
We're going to give Mr. Seeger there a chance to stop that train.
That was 50 seconds of a trailer that went 3 minutes, and I swear to you, it gives away the whole show.
So Atomic Snakes on a Train.
Cool. Atomic Train starring Rob Lowe. He is a train wreck investigator that has to stop this train. There is a nuclear bomb on the train. The train is heading to Denver. In the show, there's also like chemicals on the train that react to water, like they explode when water hits it. I forget what it is, potassium, something, something, something. Mm-hmm. At some point, there is a helicopter or water plane that tries to douse the train for some reason. It ignites and triggers the nuclear bomb. It blows up just outside of Denver. This is all in the trailer. And then like there's a rescue operation. Then it becomes sort of like... the NBC movie of the week version of that John Cusack movie where everything wrong happens. Is that 1999, 2000? You know what movie I'm talking about?
2012.
Yeah, the 2012 movie. It's sort of like that. They show everything in the trailer. Like the only thing they don't show in the trailer is the closing credits. It is sort of amazing that they give away the whole kit and caboodle. Because this was like a multi-day thing, I think. I'm not sure if it was...
Yeah, it was a mini...
Yeah, it was a mini series. So you didn't really need to watch the first episode based on this trailer at all. Despite all that, despite all the money they put into it, I looked it up. It was beat by Joan of Arc on CBS Part 1, starring Lily Sobieski and Powers Booth.
Oh, Jesus.
And Neil Patrick Harris and Olympia Dukakis.
Wow. Oh,
God. Kind of amazing.
Wow.
I'm amazed.
I would have bet money... that Atomic Train didn't come out until Television Without Pity existed, which in mid-May it did not. Dawson's Rap did, but TWAP didn't.
Right. We're still a few months away. Yeah.
Right. But mainly because I think it must have been because every time I had a poll, like anything that where I could wedge in Atomic Train as a poll option, I would. Like, I think at some point I made an Atomic Handcart joke and I never saw it, but it was just so still such a punchline for me.
Yeah.
Oh, Atomic Train. Were we ever so young and irradiated?
Rob Lowe still, like, West Wing started after this, right?
Right.
I mean, so you kind of can't blame us for being like, that shit's not going to last until October. Well,
I didn't name a guest, but I needed somebody young. So who's our youngest guest now? And then we'll put him in there. So
our youngest guest now, Stephanie Kangro, probably.
Okay. So she was probably like 12 around this time or so.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
All right. So let's use that to go around the dial. Tara will talk about the Mad About You finale, which sort of, to read it, sort of seemed like it had shades of How I Met Your Mother ending, where they kind of skip ahead and the kid is telling the story.
Yeah. It was one of the first time jump finales, I think.
Oh.
Certainly in a sitcom.
Do you actually remember the episode? Was it good? Was it bad?
Oh, yeah. I remember it. I've watched it since then. Yeah. It's set in the future, and it's their daughter, Mabel, who in this episode is played by Janine Garofalo, has become a filmmaker, and she's made a movie where she appears like sort of as the narrator that's about her parents' marriage. And we find out that they got divorced at some point during her childhood and then ended up getting back together when she was an adult. It's okay. As those go, it's, you know, it's fine.
Right.
It's hard to do that in sitcoms, as we have sadly learned many times since then.
So after Tara talks about Mad About You, we have, for some reason, Stephanie Kangro's first appearance when she was 12 on the podcast. And she has this explain what the hell Monica Lewinsky's all about in Saturday Night Live that week. And we have to sort of like dance around a lot of issues. And it was very awkward and unfulfilling for all involved. Then Sarah's up next, and Sarah's talking about Doppelgangland episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. The Willow versus Willow episode that launched 1,000 slash fics.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, me on Around the Dial, and I'm talking about the Futurama episode Hell Is Other Robots and how much I enjoyed the little ditty at the end, of which you can hear a little bit right now.
Fencing diamonds, fixing cockfights, publishing indecent magazines. You'll pay for every crime. Knee deep in electric slime. You'll suffer till the end of time. Enduring tortures, most of which rhyme. Trapped forever here in robot hell.
And then it's on to the canon, where I am submitting Northern Exposure 4.4 Heroes episode, and I make a very brief case for this episode explaining how cool it would be to fling a coffin into a remote lake via trebuchet for one's funeral. And then Tara and Sarah push for details on plot and characterization and theme and symbolism, but I'm just making flingy noises in response to everything they ask, and the episode is voted out because I really make no case for it beyond the fact that I think... having a trebuchet at your wedding is kind of cool.
Here is how attached Canada as a culture is to the concept of the trebuchet. The hockey soap opera I used to recap for SoapNet called MVP had a character named Damien Trebuchet, who was the poor man's Keanu Reeves.
Sure. Moving on to winner and loser. The winner is Susan Lucci, who finally got her Emmy after 20 years. That happened mid-May. Loser of the week is Sarah. We said goodbye to Dana Plato this week, and Sarah was so saddened that since then could not enunciate the title of the TV show in which Dana Plato starred, forever saying it as
Different Strokes.
Of course.
Sorry, I was trying not to laugh. That wasn't a good one.
The most mournful edition ever.
And then in Game Time, we play a Y2K bug-themed Game Time in which I describe a scene in which the upcoming Y2K bug plays havoc with the character or setting of the show, and you have to identify the show. Here's a sample question. ABC is forced to pay out $100 million to John Carpenter when a Pentium 386 drops the decimal point.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
That is correct. And that is my mid-May extra hot grade.
Next time we have an older guest on, or like old, by older, I mean someone our age or older, you should do that as a game, because that's a really funny idea.
Yeah. The Y2K. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Although, speaking of people's age, I just did some quick math in my head, and I think at this point, Stephanie Kangro would have been more like 8 or 9.
Yeah, so, if that.
Her asking us about Monica Lewinsky is even more inappropriate, but love it. Okay, here's my rundown for the week of October 10th, 1999.
Ooh.
At this point, we are still in the thick of premiere season, so our lead topic is the series premiere of Roswell and the WB. Therefore, obviously, our guest is Dan Rogge.
Aw.
Not sure in this alternate timeline if Television Without Pity exists and he's recapping it, but, you know, it feels right. For Around the Dial, because of all the premieres, some of us are sampling shows that we're only now getting around to. For me, that is Judging Amy, which appeals to all of my pinko tendencies and interests.
Why isn't that streaming anywhere? I am not a crackpot.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. Used to be on every day on some, not USA, but something like that. Not
one of
FX
those like
either.
The like Jesus-y one, even yeah, more maybe. Like spiritual than Ion, like Up.
Or right, right.
Could Halo be. Or whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah. Bummer. Bring it back.
Yep.
Yeah. Has a social worker as one of its main characters, which is very interesting and honestly a job that we do not see done enough on television / in pop culture in general, because it's very important and they do really interesting and sometimes difficult stuff. Lots of stakes there. Good for procedurals. Anyone pick this up? Dan has not yet gotten around to creating a musical based on political history of the scandalous late 90s sort, but he is sampling a new show. He's bringing us the fourth episode of The West Wing called A Proportional Response, and not sure how to feel about it yet, much as the rest of us weren't. That's his Around the Dial. Sarah D. Bunting, much as I was forced in her imagining to watch Dawson's Creek, she's checking out the premiere of Kevin Williamson's new drama on ABC called Wasteland, not knowing it's only four episodes away from getting canceled. If I recall correctly, that one did not last.
There were a few. It was like Wasteland, Wonderland, mm-hmm. Whipland. Like they all lasted like two or three
mm-hmm.
and were peopled by, you know, young poreless beauties and had yes. no chance. Although Wonderland was about like a, I think about a mental institution.
Yeah, that sounds right. Ugh. Not to be confused with a movie about John Holmes.
No.
There's that one too.
Or the theme park.
Right. And Dave, also because just our TV schedule is so packed, he had to reach back a week and talk about the Futurama episode Mars University.
Oh, sure.
About a monkey of moderate intelligence who just wants to go to business school. Such a good one. For the canon, Dan Rogge is going to present Twin Peaks Season 1, Episode 3, which is all about Laura Palmer's funeral. This is the one where her creep dad like throws himself on the coffin and makes a big scene. Retrospectively, much more interesting or you know, creepy than we knew at the time. Mm. Also, the episode where Cheryl Lee appears as Laura's identical cousin. Great soap trope. So that's fun to talk about. Good canon fodder, as it were. Someone wanted to present that as an actual canon now, I think that they could. Not sure how we all got to watch this, though, because it's 1999. I guess we all had to go to the video store and rent it.
People had tapes of it. I will bet you American money that Rogge had and probably still has tapes.
Well, do you remember on the forums for Mighty Big TV, every big show had the tape exchange thread?
Oh, yeah.
Where people would be like, I need this particular episode, and like they would pay somebody the postage to send them a copy of some episode, and that's how people did it before streaming TV.
We had to use it ourselves sometimes if people's VCRs right. crapped out.
That story sounds like we were mining for gold in the Californian gold rush, and that was like 20 years ago. Like that sounds crazy. Like we had to send magnetic tape across to Crunchy by post.
Yeah.
A team of mules used to pick it up from my house and drive it to the post office.
Oh, yeah. But even at this stage in like technology, it was not necessarily the case that shows, especially a culture like Twin Peaks, would have been released for like home purchase on VHS or DVD, which at the time was like not brand new, but just about.
Oh, and I'm just talking about like tapes that people had that they had taped.
Oh, no, I know. But I mean, if we put out the call and no one had it, like we would have had to go to extreme measures. Like, I don't know if it would be accessible.
The release cycle was longer too. Like now, like a movie is out for demand like 3 months after it leaves the theaters or something like that. But like a show could take two years or so to get its way onto a, you know, a home format that you could actually buy. Like it was not nearly as fast of a turnaround as it is now.
And a whole season just took up physically so much space too.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it was like two episodes per cassette.
Right.
times 11.
Oh, God. Ugh. Yeah, I just want to remind you of this, Dave, next time that we're looking for something to watch and like on the 100 titles that I have saved on our various streaming platforms, you're like, I don't want to watch anything. Now your standards are very, very high because they can be. Unlike then when like any title of a movie that we recognized on our floating like on-screen cable guide was right. Like, oh, wow, let's watch that. I know what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Back when you couldn't stop the TV guide.
Uh-huh.
You just had to wait for the 365 to roll over again.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think in 99, you could. I think it was dynamic then, at least the one that we had in when we lived in LA, which was 98.
Well, I remember some well-to-do friends had TiVo or something back then. Like that was just coming out and they're all like, look at this. Beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop. We're like, what the hell is that?
I think TiVo was still a few years away at this point.
Yeah,
too.
I think so.
Yeah. The first time I remember it was when we went to visit the Weebs in LA. They had it because I remember thinking, they had turned into very bad TV watchers because they would talk over live TV and then be like, oh, I missed that, back it up. And it was infuriating to us because we didn't have it. And that was like around the time of the Monica Chandler wedding. And that was 2001. Moving on to our winner.
How Tara Carbon dates these things is amazing.
Louis De Palma was number one on TV Guide's list of the top 50 TV characters of all time. That seems insane to me. Really? Louis De Palma? I mean, God bless, but wow.
I don't even know who that is. Is that the Taxi guy?
I don't either.
That's the Danny DeVito character from Taxi.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Dang. In 1999?
The top 50 TV characters of all time. Even in 1999, surely there were better TV characters of all time than that. Whatever. Congrats to him. Loser of the week, the industry or practice or art of wrestling, because Gorilla Monsoon passed away at age 62, former commentator and wrestler. And that's my rundown.
That was 20 years ago. It seems like maybe 200 years ago.
I know.
That's really crazy. Does.
That was fun. Let's do this again in another year.
Yeah, great idea, Sarah.
Thanks.
Where an atomic blast can tear a city apart.
Where are they?
Come on, we don't have time!
But never destroy the love that holds a family together.
Oh, Jesus. A hero falls 10,000 feet!
It's time to turn on!
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 30, Extra Hot Groovy. I am Brown Acid David T. Cole, and I'm here with Giant Leap for Mankind, Sarah D. Bunting.
Thunk.
And First Brick at Stonewall Thrower, Tara Ariano.
Smashy, smashy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Extra Extra Hot Great. Patreon supporters, thank you so much for your support. Back in July, we imagined what an Extra Hot Great would have looked like in 1999. Today, we're going back even further to 1969. Nice. It was a big year in the news, and we're probably all well sick of retrospectives on Charles Manson and the moon landing. But what was going on in TV land in these fractured United States 50 years ago? We are going to rough out episodes of Extra Hot Great per 1969. We'll each be proposing main topics around the dials, canons slash known acts, and winner loser candidates and possible celebrity guests. I left that open to our panel. So let us begin with Mr. David T. Cole. Dave, what is the main show that we would be discussing in a 1969 iteration of Extra Hot Great?
All right. The main topic is too many self-titled variety shows. We demand better. So I was going through the list. A good one-third of the top TV shows of the season were the actor name show. We have The Red Skelton Show, The Doris Day Show, The Bill Cosby Show, The Jim Neighbors Hour, The Carol Burnett Show, The Dean Martin Show, The Johnny Cash Show, The Glenn Campbell something-something hour. Plus new shows that year, the Leslie Uggam Show, the Debbie Reynolds Show, the Engelbert Humperdinck Show, the Smothers Brothers Show, Johnny Cash Presents the Everly Brothers Show, the Tim Conway Show. That's not counting all the ones that didn't even crack the top 30 or were new, including the Andy Williams Show, Andy Williams Presents Ray Stevens Show, the Jackie Gleason Show, the Beautiful Phyllis Diller Show, the Jonathan Winters Show, and the Don Rickles Show. And I'm sure there's more that I missed. So the main topic is, can we please have some shows where things actually happen, like with cops or like hospitals or something? And then we talk about how cool it'd be to like tell stories from books, but like on TV form. All right. So that's my main topic. Next.
My lead topic is The Brady Bunch, a seminal show in my childhood, even though by the time I started watching it, it had already been off the air for several years and also never really was a ratings juggernaut. Like, it was always sort of dragging ass. I think it was on Friday nights a lot, and it was paired with the Partridge Family, and I guess people just were not staying home to watch the story of a man named Brady. But I married a man named Brady and I named our dog Bear E. Williams, so obviously that's going to be my lead topic, but I think it's going to be a pretty short segment because what can you say? The Bradys are sharing a bed. Interesting. And now we're done. Tara, what you got for your lead topic?
My lead topic is a sketch show called Turn On. This is an ABC show that was created by Ed Friendly and George Schlatter, who were the producers of Roan and Martin's Laugh-In. It was contracted with, they contracted with Bristol Myers, the pharma company, to develop the show. Originally, it was supposed to be a 13-week run. However, it was canceled partway through its only episode. Now, in our time, that might mean, oh, the second episode didn't air. Well, that is true. But it is also true that in Cleveland, they did not come back to it after the first commercial break. Like, they canceled it mid-episode and did not continue airing.
Wow.
Gorgeous.
When the bad buzz started spreading west, several people in the Western time zones decided not to broadcast the show at all, including, according to Wikipedia, Portland, Oregon's KATU, Seattle, Washington's Como, and Denver's KBTV. We have decided, they said, without hesitation, that it would be offensive to a major segment of the audience. So this was like a notorious flop. Harlan Ellison wrote about it in the 1980 book, The Worst TV Shows Ever. That wasn't in that book. He wrote that in the Los Angeles Free Press, saying it wasn't that it was a bad show, it was that it was an awkward show. But when they describe it, production executive says it was a visual comedic sensory assault involving animation, videotape, stop action film, electronic distortion, computer graphics, even people, and that it focused almost exclusively on sex as a comedic subject. So I'm going to say it was just like maybe way ahead of its time, because that sounds like liquid television to me. But anyway, in 1969, America was not ready in a very aggressive way. So Turn On. It's my lead topic.
That is amazing. I just love that it was canceled mid-episode. Like, this is a joke that I make all the time about, like, Desmond Pfeiffer and stuff like that. That, like, they just cranked it, like, Poochie. Like, he just disappeared from it, like, in the middle of the cell. But I didn't realize that that had ever actually happened. That's something.
Yep.
Dave, where are we going around the dial for you?
All right, Tara's first up, and she's talking about this new show that just landed here stateside called Monty Python's Flying Circus. She watched the first episode, Wither Canada, featuring the funniest joke in the world, the skit, not the actual funniest joke in the world, which is a pretty good skit. That's the one where they start reading the funniest joke in the world and die immediately because it's too funny. And then all the efforts to recreate the funniest joke in the world, one person at a time, et cetera, et cetera. You've seen it. Our guest, Jeff Foxworthy, sings the praises of a new show called Hee Haw, noting how funny it is when people pop up in the middle of a cornfield to tell jokes. And then he strums his banjo and disappears in an explosion of grits. Sarah is talking about a sort of revolving time slot. Collectively, it's called The Bold Ones. And then The Bold Ones rotates each week between the new doctors, the lawyers, and the law enforcers. So it's sort of like a DIY Law and Order prototype by the sounds of it that spans over 3 weeks. So you can kind of mix and match.
Or like Chicago PD, Fire, and Med, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And for mine, I'm talking about the end of Star Trek. And I'm saying, well, here's this little sci-fi show. It's going to end after this season, season three. But season three wasn't all that great. All the good episodes happened in season one and two. So, oh, well, I guess that's the end of the road for Star Trek. And then we close the book on Around the Dial.
Cute.
Well, I did not pick out Around the Dial candidates for other people. But I think if I had, I would have assumed that Dave was talking about Monty Python. I, of course, am talking about the Dean Martin show. Not the Dean Martin Variety Hour, but I have derived so many hours of joy from watching the infomercials for Dean Martin's celebrity roasts on a loop, Who Among Us, etc., that I would definitely check out the Dean Martin show. I don't think I would find it as satisfying as present day Sarah has found those infomercials, but that's what I would be talking about. And then I don't know what Tara would be talking about. Perhaps Laugh-In versus Turn-On?
Perhaps.
Two shows, one slot? Who is to say?
Mine is because I tried to stick to the actual week that Turn-On aired, which was February 5th. My Around the Dial is a Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation called Teacher Teacher, in which David McCallum from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. plays an alcoholic teacher trying to put his life back together and encouraging an intellectually disabled boy to come out of isolation. Although the New York Times review of this project did not describe him thus, the word R is right there in the headline. I know it was another age, but still, yow, it's very jarring.
Wow.
I, alas, could not read the actual review because it's in like their Time machine and I'm not a subscriber, so I couldn't look it up. But, you know, feel free. Teacher, Teacher, Hallmark Hall of Fame. This project goes on to get nominated for 7 Emmys and win for Outstanding Dramatic Program. So good job, I guess.
TV was worse back then, though.
Yeah.
All right, canon, no knack time. I was interested to see if Dave and I crossed the streams on this one, and it doesn't sound like we did, but Dave, what would you be bringing?
The canon will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered, because we're talking about The Prisoner. Season 1, Episode 7, Many Happy Returns, I think my favorite episode of the run. The Prisoner is a cult show. It's also a cult show that I put in the lifelong bachelor category, because everybody I know who likes The Prisoner, that's not me, is not married and never will be. You know, your mutton chopped MIT flea market shopping kind of guy. I'm joking. But the show was definitely ahead of its time. It has a tone and a psychological element that wouldn't really resurface in a meaningful way to TV for a couple decades, probably. And even though it is dated in some respects, it is also kind of timeless because they set most of the show in the village, which is very dressed up. It is very opinionated in its fashion and architect styles. So there is a certain timeless quality to it. This particular episode is pretty infamous for the end. I'm not going to say too much because after I thought about this, I thought I should actually do this for real. So it is now in our...
You should.
Yeah.
I taught this episode in class and I really enjoyed it. So I think you definitely should.
So episode 107, Many Happy Returns, is my canon.
I went with a no-knack. It is the final episode of Star Trek. It's called Turnabout Intruder. I don't remember having seen it, although I must have, but it's apparently considered the worst one in the series run. I think it's the only episode that was actually produced in calendar year 1969, but it was like ready to go in March and they didn't burn it off until June. And in a lot of markets, they just like dumped it at the same time across the country, I think. So in New York, it was airing at like midnight. Anyway, that would be my no-knack presentation. And I was thinking that Dave would roll out a Star Trek original series of some sort for this slot. But when I think about it, The Prisoner is a much more Dave choice and probably much more enjoyable for the panel.
Yeah, season 3 of Star Trek really just was sort of there. Like, if you look at anybody's top 10 list, there's 1 to 0 season 3 episodes.
I was just looking at the episodes and I was like, I guess I'll put this in for the no-knack because it is the end of the series and sort of the beginning of like basically internet revival culture, like decades before the internet existed.
Right. I mean, I guess the most interesting thing about this episode being the last episode is that somehow with only three seasons, Star Trek became this massive syndication success, drove fandom to resurrect it and do the movie and everything that's happened after that. So it's sort of strange because now we think of a syndicated show as like 100 episodes minimum. I mean, there's not even syndication anymore, I guess. Now it's all just who's going to buy the streaming rights. It's a unique case how Star Trek sort of gained popularity.
For sure. Tara?
Well, I went further back in time to an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents called Lamb to the Slaughter. This is based on it was adapted from a Roald Dahl short story, not one of the ones he wrote for kids, one of the grown-up ones, which are very dark and usually satirical. In this one, Barbara Bel Geddes, who would go on to be the matriarch on Dallas, but of course is not yet at this point. She's from Vertigo. She clobbers her husband to death with a frozen leg of lamb, and I won't say what happens after that, but it sounds pretty good. We all know how I feel about women killing men. I'm pro, so, you know, that would be my pick.
Excellent. It's a leg of lamb. Like, that's a moment in TV history, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dave, who are your winners and losers of the week, or winner and loser of the week?
For our winner, Dogs Take a Seat, the winners are Human Eyeballs, all daytime TV on all three major networks are now in glorious color. All of the programming in color. You don't look at black and white anymore because we all know anything in black and white sucks. Loser of the week is A Tale of Two Dicks. Dick York collapses on the set of Bewitched.
Yeah.
He has to resign because he's just unhealthy enough to come back to the set. And they replace him with Dick Sargent, forever confusing 90% of America on who actually starred in Bewitched and was the husband, because I don't think a lot of people realize this, two different people. Dick York versus Dick Sargent, that started in 1969.
My winner is Kids, because Sesame Street and Fat Albert both premiered around this time. My mother likes to say Sesame Street taught me to read. That is not true. She did it. Thanks, Barb. Well done. But Sesame Street was on pretty much nonstop in my house in the mornings and the evenings when it aired again on WNET for like 10 years, because by the time I was sort of starting to outgrow it, my brother was little. So, and you don't really outgrow it because there's jokes for older kids and adults. And you've also seen them all a million times and you recognize the skits and they're fun. Fat Albert, whatever, Cosby, whatever, but that was a pretty groundbreaking show. So I'm going to allow it this once. My loser is Spiro Agnew, kind of just on general principles, but also because he went after network news commentaries as basically fake news. He didn't use those words, but nice prequel, Spiro. Enjoy your retirement. Tara.
My winner is Richard Pryor, a up-and-coming comic who debuts this week in the first episode of This Is Tom Jones, so we might have touched on him in our lead topic in Dave's iteration of this episode. Loser is Christmas, as Boris the Grinch Karloff passes away.
What a legacy. You died. Yeah. Now you're a loser.
I said Christmas. I didn't say him.
Oh, I thought you said him.
No. Okay. No, Christmas.
All right. Sorry, Christ.